I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax News listeners. On this edition of the program, we're revisiting the subject of Israel and Palestine, this time with anthropologist Jeff Halper of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and the One Democratic State campaign. I want to get rolling straight into the conversation. So, without any further ado, Jeff Halper joins us to discuss the one state solution as it relates to Israel-Palestine, as well as a number of other issues, including political Zionism versus cultural Zionism, and much, much more. So, with that in mind, here's my conversation with Jeff Halper. Welcome to Parallax Views, Jeff Halper, director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and co-founder of the One Democratic State campaign, and also the author of a pretty recent book, I believe, Decolonizing Israel, Liberating Palestine. How are you doing today, Jeff?
I'm doing well. Late at night. It's actually midnight here in my world, in Jerusalem.
So, for the sake of my listeners, could you give a little bit of background about yourself and how you became involved in looking at issues like Palestinian liberation, Zionism, settler colonialism? You were, I was watching a video, I think, with the late Michael Brooks, who I was good friends with. And I think you said that you were involved with left activism even going back to, you know, the 60s and 70s, right?
Yeah. No, that's right. That was the point. I come from Minnesota, actually, and northern Minnesota. I was very active in the 60s, in the 60s. You know, the college I went to, McAllister in St. Paul, was a fairly radical school. And, you know, we had SDS, and I was very involved in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. You know, part of the 60s that people don't remember that well is the identity politics of it. You know, this is a time when you begin to have African-American identity emerging, you know, roots. And the whole idea that, you know, validating your ethnic roots. In other words, that the United States is not a melting pot. We all didn't melt, certainly not the Black people. And therefore, there's something, you know, and on the contrary, our ethnic roots really have a lot more content and meaning for us, substance, than this kind of white bread American stuff. You know, we have to remember, not only did the Blacks go back to kind of the ethnic roots, but also the Latinos, you know, with Cesar Chavez, the Native Americans, with the whole Native American movement and you know, Vine Deloria and Russell Means and the American Indian movement and so on. And even the white kids, the WASPy middle-class kids that came out of the white bread culture, you know, that was dominant, they also felt it was empty. And so you had the emergence, the invention of a culture, the hippies, you know, that all of a sudden, you know, they begin to develop neighborhoods and ways of dressing and foods. There were certain hippie foods that were kind of good, ways of smoking, you know, music, certainly, a whole, you know, all the elements you need of a counterculture, because they, in a sense, they had lost this ethnic culture they could have gone back to. So that was a very, and I'm Jewish, but I'm not religious. If I had been religious, it would have been easier. You know, I could have found some meaning in that. If I had been a New Yorker, I probably wouldn't have gone to Israel, because it would have been a New Yorker in the East Coast, certainly enough Jewishness around that I could have found, you know, that Minnesota was pretty thin on Jewish stuff. And in a sense, you know, there was an identity shift. I kind of began to, I was alienated from white American society, certainly with Vietnam and Nixon and all of that. You know, my Jewish identity became more important to me as an ethnic identity, but not being religious kind of led me to an Israeli, you know, identity. Not that I was a Zionist. I didn't know anything about Zionism, and I never came out of that kind of a background. But like I say, there was sort of an identity shift from being an ethnic Jew in America to becoming a, I don't want to say nationalist, certainly I wasn't a nationalist, but where your ethnic identity becomes primary. And, you know, and so the shift going to Israel sort of made sense. So I, in a way, I became Israeli before I moved to Israel, which happened in 1973, when I actually came here to do my PhD work, and, you know, and I stayed. But, you know, it's an example, I think, you know, everybody has different stories. In the 60s, late 60s and 70s, you had a lot of people from the left that moved from it to Israel, from the U.S., from Europe, from Latin America, quite a few people. And it was a different world then. You know, Israel wasn't as crazy as it was now. I have to admit, the Palestinian issue was not, certainly the issue, Palestinian issue was there, of course, but not the issue of the refugees. So the whole idea that somehow Israel was there and that the occupation after 67 would be temporary, you know, and that we could be a part of the peace movement, and we could be a part of a movement of reconciling, finally, Israel with the Palestinians and with the wider Arab world. That was sort of the idea. And I felt that was more of a meaningful struggle for me than what I would have been engaged to in the States. So I moved from the very beginning. I was involved in the Israeli peace movement. I mean, now I understand years later that that was naive. And that it wasn't, the occupation was not temporary, and there was no reconciliation to be had. And the Palestinian refugees are an issue, you know, but back in those days, it was kind of different. Also, don't forget, there was a labor government. Israel was kind of a socialist country.
Yeah, labor Zionism. It was sort of the left wing of the Zionist movement.
Yeah, Andy. I mean, it wasn't really, but that was the facade of it all.
I actually wanted to get into that. You said it was the facade of it all. What do you mean by that when we talk about labor Zionism? And I guess more broadly, maybe we should define terms here a little bit for people that hear the term Zionism and may have a vague understanding of it. But, you know, they've only heard it in passing.
So let me get into a 3-minute lecture here. And that is this, that Zionism, you know, wasn't an evil thing. I mean, today it's gotten this evil, like, you know, it's taking over the world, or it wasn't evil. It was a Eastern European nationalism that emerged in the late 19th century, together with Russian nationalism and Polish nationalism and Hungarian nationalism. All of Europe was becoming nationalist, and the Jews got caught up in that. Some Jews, a very small minority, it wasn't most Jews. It was maybe 3 or 4% of the Jews became Zionists, actually. But it was, you know, there was a certain logic to it, that the Jews are a national group like other national groups. The difference being that every other national group, except the Roma, except the Gypsies, had a national territory that they could call their own, whether or not they had succeeded in having a state or not. You know, so you had, you know, Prussia, you have Germany, you had Poland for Poles, you had Russia for Russians, you had Hungary for Hungarians, France for the French. All right, the Basques were kind of in between things somehow with self-determination. Certainly the Irish for a long time were in between. And you know, it took a time for the nation and the state to kind of come together in as they sort of did in the 19th century, just to a certain degree. And the Jews were sort of the odd man out. You know, they weren't accepted in Europe, certainly not West, in Eastern Europe mainly. not Central Europe so much, not Western Europe, but certainly in Eastern Europe. They were not accepted. They were seen as a people apart. And they were seen as a nation apart, really, in many ways. And so when this nationalist logic that was taking, you know, sweeping Europe at that time, you know, reached the Jews, it kind of made sense. Yes, we're a national group. We should go back. Now, what about our territory? Where's our territory? Well, it's obviously the land of Israel. That was in the Bible. That's where we came from. We're in exile. That's where they began to make up stories. Because the whole story about being exiled by the Romans and now it's time to go home, that's just a myth. The Romans never exiled the Jews. But at any rate, the Jews, you know, so what happened was they began to see, all right, Palestine, although they called it the land of Israel, as their homeland. Arabs had nothing to do with the story. That's important. It wasn't against Arabs. Arabs were irrelevant. And in a sense, Zionism became what we call today a settler colonial movement. Very similar, with a similar logic to the whites that came, the Europeans that came to the U.S., that came to Canada, the French that came to Algeria, for example, in West Africa, the Portuguese in Angola, Mozambique, the British that went to Australia or New Zealand or Kenya. You know, these are all settler colonial movements that meant this. It is very important. Colonialism, which was a big thing in the 19th and early 20th century, was when a country came and conquered another country, basically, in order to exploit its wealth and to exploit its resources and to exploit its labor, like the British in India, for example. But it wasn't to annex the country. It was to exploit it. So that India was never going to become part of Britain. You know, South Africa is another example of settler colonialism, of course. But, you know, when the Germans went to Namibia, Namibia was not going to be part of Germany. Vietnam was not going to be part of France. They were colonies. They were outside. Settler colonialism, on the other hand, is a type of colonialism in which, yes, the settlers intend to take over the country. The idea of settler colonialism is we are coming here to make this country our own. And therefore, the settlers have to make up a story about why they can do that. Why this country, this foreign country, belongs to them. Why they have rights to it. Why they have an entitlement to it, you see. And so every settler colonial movement makes up a story. Now, it usually has to do with God. You know, you have manifest destiny, or the natives are primitive, or the French had civilization, the spreading civilization, and the Jews had the Bible. We were here, it was our country. I mean, it was kind of a ready-made narrative. And now we're coming back. And whoever's here by chance doesn't belong here. So Zionism had this very famous slogan that Palestine is a land without a people. For a people without a land. So the people in Minsk and Plonsk and all these places in Eastern Europe maybe vaguely knew that there were Arabs there. I mean, you know, even then you had stereotypes of Arabs and camels and Bedouins, you know, but it was a very vague idea. So they didn't know anything about the Ottoman Empire, about Palestine, about Arab. It wasn't part of it was a Jewish story. This was our country. We're coming back. It belongs to us exclusively. And that became the Zionist narrative. And they came, and in settler colonial theory, there's this idea of an invasion. The settlers invade the country. It's not always a violent invasion, but the Zionist invasion happens in the late 1900s, 1990s. And over the course of the 20th century, they, in fact, take over Palestine. And the word they used was to Judaize the country. In other words, to make an Arab country a Jewish country, to make Palestine the land of Israel. Now, in this movement of taking over the country, again, the Arabs, we don't even use the word Palestinians. You know, the natives, the indigenous population, have no role whatsoever. They're not a side. They don't have any rights. They don't belong there. The only job, you know, you think about the Native Americans in the States. You know, I mean, they weren't, who cares? You know, we pushed it whenever we wanted to. We signed treaties once in a while with them, you know, just to kind of make it look good. But see, Israel couldn't even do that. I mean, the Palestinians were in a worse situation than the Native Americans and the States, because for everything else, the American government recognized the Native American tribes as nations. They signed treaties with them. They never respected the treaties, of course. The treaties were just a game, but they signed treaties. The Zionists could never do that with Palestinians because they claimed the country exclusively. This is exclusively a Jewish country. No one else is here. It's a land without a people. And so if they would have recognized the existence of a Palestinian people, they recognize there are a bunch of Arabs living here, but they didn't add up to a people, you see? And so they weren't going to sign treaties. They weren't going to negotiate with them. They weren't a side. And until today, Israel has not recognized the existence, let alone the national rights of a Palestinian people. Now, let me just one more sentence, then I'll let you. All right, that was Zionism. But that's what we call political Zionism. The whole idea, and this is Ben-Gurion, and this is, Rabin, and the Zionists we all know. Netanyahu, the army, the conquest, the whole idea that there has to be a Jewish state. But there was another stream of Zionism that I guess I sort of belong to, because I do think Jews have a tie to this country. I mean, this isn't like a British farmer that gets up one day and goes to Kenya because the land is cheap and he can get cheap labor. That wasn't the story here. There was a genuine tie. But there was another group of people, more eggheads, intellectuals, they weren't the masses, that were called cultural Zionists as opposed to political Zionists. And they said, yes, we were Zionists in the cultural sense. We want to come back to our homeland. We want to revive our national language. We want to live here. But we recognize and acknowledge that there is another people living here. It's actually going through the same parallel process of finding their national identity. So let's do it together. We don't need a state. We can have these two national groups living together. And in fact, we have a history of living together in this country. So in a sense, you know, there was a stream of Zionism that was more open to Palestinians, that didn't have this exclusive claim to the country. That it never went very far. You know, but in fact, it's relevant today because today what happened, political Zionism won. We conquered. We have Israel. We were beating up Gaza. We have one of the strongest armies in the world. But it's reached a dead end politically. There's nowhere else to go. We have an apartheid regime. We can't throw out the Palestinians that are more than half the population, the majority population in the country today. We have a militarized Sparta that we're living in. Nobody is really satisfied with this, but we're stuck because we're stuck in this paradigm of settler colonialism, of saying it's ours, and we can't recognize, God forbid, the Palestinians, because that undermines our entitlement. And so cultural Zionism, in a sense, shows a way out. And that's this one democratic state idea that I'm involved with, and that is that Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs can live together in one democratic state. That's a multi-ethnic state or a multinational state. That's okay, but we can live in one. So that only cultural Zionism, in a sense, shows the way out. Because this is a kind of settler colonialism in which the settlers are going to stay. I mean, it's like the U.S. as well. I mean, regardless of how unjust it was, in the end, this isn't Algeria, where the French got up and left. We're here to stay. The whites are staying in South Africa. You guys are staying in the U.S., you know. And so in a sense, we have to find a way to get a just new kind of political community organized that includes Palestinian Arabs and their national identity with Israeli Jews and their national identity in some common framework.
So there's a few. What was that?
End of lecture.
It was a good lecture. So I want to clarify that point further. So in other words, I think a lot of people think that when you're criticizing Israel, right, you're saying, oh, all these Jewish people living in Israel don't have a right to be there, that they should be kicked out. That's not really what you're saying at all.
Okay. But the irony is that the greatest critics of Israel are Jews. You know, Ron Dermer was the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. during Netanyahu and Trump's presidency. He was the U.S. Israeli ambassador in the U.S. He said last week, "Forget American Jews. They're not on our side. They don't support us anymore. We've lost them. All we have left are the evangelicals, basically." You know, so this isn't like an anti-Semitic thing that all the Jews are on one side defending Zionism and everybody that criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic. On the contrary, there's a real split because Jews abroad, you know, in the U.S. especially, but in other countries, are not religious. You know, probably 90% of the Jews abroad are not religious. And they're liberals. I mean, most of them vote, you know, for the Democrats in the U.S., certainly. 80% of American Jews voted for Biden. And in a sense, rather than religion, their Judaism is defined by human rights, social justice. I would say the prophetic tradition. That's what informs Judaism. The Jews were so active in the civil rights movement and anti-war movements. And not only in the U.S., you know, in South Africa. Some of the leaders of the ANC, the whites in the ANC, were Jews. In Mandela's first government, he had 5 white ministers, all of whom were Jews. So that's what's happening abroad. In Israel, the Jews became Zionists. In this country, began to develop a nationalistic form of Judaism, this terrible kind of merger of religion that said God gave us this country, this exclusivity, and absolutism, and nationalism, which adds to that, you see. And they've developed an Israeli Judaism that's defined by the 5 books of the Bible, not the prophetic tradition, but the first 5 books of the Bible that are very genocidal, where God commands the Israelites to wipe out every living thing except olive trees. Well, you read the book of Joshua, and you can understand where ISIS comes from. It's a pretty tough book. So that in a sense, what's happening today is a greater and greater alienation of American and Jews abroad from Israeli Jews. We're getting to be 2 separate peoples with very, very different, and American Jews can't stand Israel. You know, it's one of the greatest violators of human rights, and they define themselves by human rights. You know, the author of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was a French Jewish jurist named René Cassin. So you have that. But what's happened is, you see, that anti-Semitism is a very convenient tool for Israel. Because who wants to be called an anti-Semite? I mean, that's one of those things, you know, you could be called a communist or be called a sex molester. These are the kinds of things you can't just say no. And, you know, it sticks to you. And so Israel uses that, you know, that threat of calling you an anti-Semite if you criticize Israel. And there's now what's called the new anti-Semitism, which was an invention of Israel about 10 years ago, that actually says criticizing Israel is a form of anti-Semitism. And now there's a new definition of anti-Semitism. It's called the IHRA definition that Israel is trying to get governments to adopt, the American government and American states. Something like, I don't know what it is now, 15, 20 American states have adopted this definition of anti-Semitism that completely shuts down any kind of debate over Israel at universities, in the media. It becomes illegal to criticize Israel because it's a form of hate. Just criticizing Israel becomes a form of hate speech, you see? Now, the danger of that, I mean, besides the fact that, you know, you have a country in this part of the world that's the 4th largest nuclear country in the world, an occupying power, an aggressive military regime that you can't criticize. Whoa, that's kind of... the nuclear power that's outside of the of our ability to criticize it, that's kind of serious. But beyond that, you know, René Cassin, who I mentioned, who was the author of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, used to say, he was a Holocaust survivor. he used to say, you know, the Jews were persecuted in Europe because they were exceptions. You know, they weren't Russians, they weren't Poles, they weren't Christians, they weren't Muslims, or they didn't fit in anywhere. They were sort of exceptions, and the exceptions stand out, and they're the ones that you scapegoat. And therefore, anti-Semitism became the major form of prejudice in Europe. But what human rights does is human rights, which is a 20th century invention, pretty much, brings everybody under the umbrella. So anti-Semitism becomes a form of racism, and it's dealt with like other forms of racism. And Israel becomes a country that has to conform, if it wants to be part of the international community, with the norms and values of other countries through the UN that have formulated these instruments of human rights. You know, the Fourth Geneva Convention, it tells how an occupying power has to treat an occupied people. And it can't do what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. That's against our norms. So what Israel is saying is, well, we're the exception again. You see, we're the exception because the Holocaust, because whatever, we're Jews, you know, so human rights doesn't apply to us. So René Cassin used to say, because he picked up on that a long time ago, he used to say, that's a double-edged sword. It can be convenient for a while to say that human rights doesn't apply to you, but do you really want to step out of the umbrella again? Do you really want to be the exception again? You know, human rights is your protection. It doesn't mean that there's no more anti-Semitism, there's no more dangers, but it's an instrument that everybody has to fight these things. You step out of the tent and you start to be an exception, and that can help you for a while, but at the same time, that puts you in jeopardy. And it certainly put the American Jews in jeopardy and Jews abroad who are being attacked on the streets because... And I'm not certainly not justifying that. I mean, anti-Semitism is a form of racism. But what Israel has done is it's co-opted the Jews. Netanyahu gets up in the UN and says, we are the Jewish state. We represent the Jewish people. When I attack Gaza, I'm doing so in the name of the Jewish people. Well, here you get Jews in New York or Minnesota or California who are not Israelis, never voted for Netanyahu. He has no right to speak for them, doesn't agree with his policies, but all of a sudden they're co-opted. And all of a sudden and now the problem is that the American Jewish establishment goes along with this. The federations, the Hillels, the AIPAC, the American Jewish Congress, American Jewish Committee, all these mainstream organizations go along with it. If they would say, no, not in our name, no, Israel, we might love you, we might support you, whatever, but you do not speak in the name of us. We don't vote for you. We're not Israelis. You can't attack Gaza in the name of Jews from Minnesota. You can't do that. That would create that distance. But they don't do that. You see, they on the contrary, you go into a synagogue and you've got the American flag on one side of the rabbi and the Israeli flag on the other side. You know, they're always talking about we have to support Israel, 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 Israel all the time. And they then go along with this blurring of the line between Israeli and Jewish that Israel plays on. And that's what that puts the Jewish community in jeopardy in the U.S. And people obviously, you know, so the Jews say, why are you attacking us? You know, we're not responsible for Israel's policies. You know, it's not fair. But at the same time, they're exploiting that blur, that confusion, in order to, on the one hand, they do want to support Israel, so you can't attack, you can't criticize Israel or Jews because, you know, you're attacking Israel, but on the other hand, they don't want you to confuse them with Israelis, so it doesn't work both ways, and that's where I think the Jews have, not that they're responsible for those attacks, but I can understand the confusion that people have, non-Jews, between Jews and Israel, Israel has made the ties so close, and the American Jewish establishment rejected that tie.
Well, I was going to add to that. I mean, the line I always hear, I think I even heard it from Barry Weiss at one point, one of the pundits here. You know, I've heard some people say, oh, well, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism because, you know, such a high percentage of American Jews support Israel that, you know, by definition, it's anti-Semitic since the number of anti-Zionists is so small is what some of these people would say. How would you respond to that?
That's not true. I mean, now that's what's ruining Israel. Now Israel is losing the American Jewish support. You know, from Bernie Sanders, who was Jewish, you know, was one of the main critics of Israel in Congress, to the Jewish Voice for Peace, whose headquarters is in New York, which is the largest growing Jewish organization in the U.S., really an organization of the young Jewish generation that officially defines itself as anti-Zionist. They have in their official mission statement, they say we're anti-Zionist because Zionism goes against the values of Judaism, the way we see it, certainly in the U.S. So it's simply not true. See, and that's the problem with people like Barry Weiss is she tries to she also tries to co-opt all the Jews, you know, and make this, you know, this Jewish thing like something mystical that you can't criticize. But in fact, Jews are, you know, we have a very famous saying, we have 10 Jews, you have 11 different opinions. So that Jews are not, and even in Israel, you know, you have the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community here is anti-Zionist. They're Israeli citizens and they're anti-Zionist. And you have a small, like me, I belong to a small community of left, people on the left who are anti-Zionist. I would say a lot of Israelis, not the majority, but a lot of Israelis today would say, you know, Zionism, You know what Zionism means to them today? It's sort of like a goody-goody thing. You know, if you say to a kid today, you know, don't eat too much chocolate and go to bed early, he'll say, don't talk Zionism to me. Zionism has become this goody-goody kind of thing for a lot of Israelis who live in a country that for them is a normal country. They don't need that ideology anymore. But in fact, we have to criticize Zionism because it was a settler colonial movement. It's still a settler colonial movement. It's still oppressing millions of Palestinians. I wrote a book called War Against the People about Israel's military and security exports. You know, it's a tremendous support for capitalism, for enforcing capitalism abroad. And, you know, it's not only a regional power or a local power over Palestinians. It has regional, you know, it's involved in Burma, in Myanmar, in China, everywhere. Colombia, I mean, there's nowhere where Israeli arms and security stuff is, you know, Ferguson and everywhere else. So that, you know, you have to criticize Zionism and Israel. And in the end, like South Africa, Israel can't remain. You can't have a Jewish state where the Jews are the minority in the 21st century. That just can't be. And so, you know, it has to be replaced. The settler regime has to be replaced by a democratic polity that gives equal rights to everyone. And then within that polity, you can pursue your language, your identity, your institutions, your land narrative, whatever you want.
So, in regards to the Palestinians, and I don't know if you could speak to this, but it always comes up when I'm having conversations with people that may not be familiar with the history. And I'm surprised that it comes up because, you know, I think these claims have been debunked. But I've always heard people bring up this claim that I think goes back to a book called From Time Immemorial that claims, the Arabs... the Palestinians weren't indigenous. There was no indigenous Palestinians on this land. They were immigrants. Why is that wrong? And, you know, I also wanted to note, you can even see this in certain far right figures within Zionism, people like Meir Kahane, who would always say they're not Palestinians, they're Arabs. And what is this all about? Why are there these claims that the Palestinians weren't indigenous to the land?
Well, what we have to remember is that nationalism, the way we understand it today, again, was a 19th century, a late 19th century invention. So you never had it in the Middle East. The Middle East was always a mosaic of peoples. There were ethnic groups here, 1,000 ethnic groups all over the country. They were religious groups, Muslims, Jews, Christians, and other groups as well, other religious groups. You know, they were, first of all, it was part of an empire, it was part of the Ottoman Empire that extended from Libya all the way to Iraq and all the way down to Yemen at different times. But it was very fluid. You know, you had Jews, the chief rabbi sat in Istanbul in the Sultan's court, and they were chief rabbis in Palestine and in Syria and in Iraq and in Egypt. And you had kind of the idea of regions a little bit. You know, there was an idea of Palestine. There was an idea of Syria, but Palestine was a kind of part of Syria, you see. And there was a little bit of idea of Lebanon, but Lebanon didn't become a country until the French cut it out. I mean, all the countries, you know, were colonial creations. They weren't creations of the people. So that you know, the whole idea of, there was a nation here called Palestinians, and if they weren't Palestinians as a nation, they weren't indigenous, is simply not true. I mean, our history of this country is thousands of years of people coming and going all the time. There was no, I mean, if you talk about the Jews, you know, having some claim to this country, the whole biblical period, now, if you, part of the biblical period, the Romans were ruling. Part of the biblical period, the Greeks were ruling. Part of the Roman period, the Canaanites were ruling. There were all kinds of groups. And it wasn't Jewish. There was no Jews here. They were Israelites. They were Hebrews. They were, you know, but what the Judeans, they were Judeans and Israelites. There were two Jewish peoples at one time. If you want to call them Jewish, let's say Jewish, but they weren't Jewish. But at any rate, you know, this whole time where so-called Jewish nationalism was here in this country was maybe 600 years out of a 4,000-year recorded history. I mean, what about the Greeks? What about the Romans? What about the Mamelukes? What about the Ottomans? What about the the Crusaders, even? What about the Canaanites? What about the Edomites? What about the Persians? What about the Syrians, the Egyptians? I mean, there were peoples, the Nabataeans, the Phoenicians, I mean, the Hittites. You could go on and on and on. The peoples that came and go and left, and they stayed, and they intermarried, and they mixed, and the identities changed over the years, and colors changed, and that's what it really was. There was no, the indigenous people were the people that lived here. They were born here. You know, there wasn't one indigenous people that came and left and another one that came and left. It was nothing like that. It was a continuity, a fluidity. So in the 19th century, the late 19th century, when Zionism came here, the indigenous population was a Palestinian Arab population. They didn't always call themselves Palestinian. They didn't have a national identity, again, because there was no nation state in the Middle East. They didn't have a national idea so much. They were Arabs. They were Muslims. They were Syrians, maybe, sort of. They weren't really Ottomans, although they lived in the Ottoman Empire. They didn't really identify with it. But, you know, they were Ottoman citizens and Ottoman parliament. But there was a Palestinian delegate to the Ottoman parliament. There was a newspaper that was called here in Jerusalem called Philistine. There was a Palestinian identity and a culture and a food, you know. And that's really like it was in the rest of the world. You know, if you'd go somewhere, if you go through Africa, you go through Europe, you'd go through Latin America, you didn't go through countries, but you did go through cultural areas where the foods changed and the colors changed and the dress changed and the languages changed. And it wasn't, you know, hard and fast with boundaries like that, you know, and the people intermixed and sometimes they fought each other. That's the way you really have to look at it. So Jews were a part of it. But Jews in those days, the Jews that were living here, and there were Jews in Palestine, they were Palestinians. They were the indigenous population. They were Sephardi Jews. They were Yemenite. Some Yemenite Jews were here. They were Ashkenazi Jews here, religious people, especially in Jerusalem and Tiberias, that lived here. And they lived here. They were the indigenous population. If you'd have asked them, they wouldn't have said we're Zionists. They wouldn't have said we're a Jewish nation. They wouldn't have said we're Israelis, certainly. They would have said, like everybody else, we're, Jews living in Palestine, Syria, Ottoman Empire. And that's really more the way to look at it. So it was the Zionists that came out of Europe that brought this idea of nationalism. And when they all of a sudden came and said, we are going to conquer Palestine. And then you had the British colonialism come in as well. And of course, Syria was then cut off after World War I from Palestine by the French. So now you didn't have Syria anymore, because this was a sort of a part of Syria. All of a sudden, the Palestinians said, hey, we have to begin to organize on a national basis and develop a national identity that we never thought of before, because we're under pressure. And all of a sudden, we're a country, and all of a sudden, we have to prove to Europe and Britain that it's a mandate over us and the League of Nations that we have the right to run our lives. We have self-determination. Have we ever heard of self-determination? That's a European-American invention, you see. But now that's the way the European colonial world works, and now we have to start conforming to that. So you did have the beginning of Palestinian nationalism early on at the turn of the 20th century. It was new. But so was Zionism, was the new Jewish nationalism. Jews never, because the Jews in the U.S. don't consider themselves national, Jewish nationals. So not all the Jews accept this national identity of Israelis, certainly of Jews, and every country. Germany only became a country in the 1860s. Italy only became a country around then as well. So all these countries are new. These identities are new. And in fact, you see in Italy today, a chance that the whole country could split and the North could go to be another country. That's what they want, and to get rid of the South. So that even this idea of nationalism and national identity isn't such an accepted, in concrete sort of thing that the way we talk about it. In other words, the word we use in anthropology, I'm an anthropologist, is we reify cultures as if it's a real thing. It isn't a real thing. It's a culture, but it's just a snapshot of a time of different things happening, and you can't talk about a culture in a kind of a like a country with a boundary and this is its history and this is what it thinks, and it's somehow homogeneous. It's not homogeneous.
I'm glad that you mentioned being an anthropologist, because I've always wanted to ask you, after reading your work, what role can anthropology play in helping us, especially, people in America who are trying to learn more and more about Israel and Palestine? What role can anthropology play in helping us understand these things more? Because, people often try to talk about things in terms of, this is a religious thing. But I think the anthropological angle can provide us with a certain kind of angle and insight that we can't get elsewhere.
No, that's right. I mean, I think the great anthropological contribution was the whole idea of culture. Culture, because culture sort of holds us together as particular groups in a way. But like I said, in a very loose kind of a way, because you can join a culture, you can become an immigrant, you can convert religiously. Sometimes you can be captured, raped and brought in by force. I mean, you can be excluded and join another group. In other words, cultures are very porous. But nevertheless, people tend to congregate together. They want to speak. They speak a certain language. They follow certain rituals. They have common values. They see themselves as a people, sort of. Again, the edges are very vague, but there is a sort of an idea of an us. There is an us. And I think that's a useful idea in anthropology. But the us is a very complex thing. I mean, sometimes it's more religiously defined. So there is a concept, for example, of Dar al-Islam. In other words, the idea of a Muslim nation or a Muslim people. So in a sense, that's a culture too. I mean, that's a very diverse culture, because it goes from Morocco to Indonesia. And the second largest Muslim country in the world is Nigeria. Not even the Arab world. The Arab world is only a piece of that. But there is a sense of us Muslims. We go to Mecca, we pray, we use Arabic as a language, we have a common idea. So, you know, that becomes a part of the culture. You can't separate Egyptian culture or Palestinian culture from Islam, even though they're not all Muslims. You have Copts, and you have Christian Palestinians and Jewish Palestinians and so on. And then you've got the national pieces, you have ethnic pieces of it as well. So, you know, part of the Palestinian nation, for example, are Bedouins. You know, the question, are Bedouins Palestinians, you see, or Circassians? Are they, you know, so there's different ethnic groups that have their own story within a larger culture. And sometimes they're inside the culture, sometimes they're outside the culture. Jews, for example, were a part of Palestinian culture until Zionism came in with its own culture. And it said, if you want to join our culture, which is the dominant one, you have to become an Israeli. You can't be a Palestinian anymore. So the Jews, that for thousands of years have lived with Palestinians here, all of a sudden found themselves alienated from Palestinians and identifying more voluntarily or not with Israel as Israelis. So you see that shift within our lifetimes of an identity. So identity shifts, they change, and culture is a resource. We use culture. We use culture for you know, consolidating ourselves as a people, for consolidating an economy, for working the land, for doing, you know, having certain unity. But we also use it as a way of claiming other lands, of the right to fight other peoples. We use it as a form of protection. We use it sometimes to unite with other people. We like Dar al Islam that says, you know, this is a pan Muslim identity. So we're uniting all the different peoples into one people. So I think that's really the contribution of anthropology, this idea of culture, but in a very fluid way. So you can see nodes of culture. You can talk about cultures. You can understand. I mean, the Palestinians certainly see themselves as a culture, but they're not a culture that stands in strong contradistinction from Arab culture, Syrian culture. You know, they're all pieces of you know, and Jewish culture even. So it's useful anthropology. It's complex, but within that that's the point. Within that complexity, you can begin to see how cultures work, but you can also see how they change, and then you begin to understand what has to happen when two cultures come in conflict with each other, like we have today, the Israeli Jewish culture. And state, especially when a culture all of a sudden gets a state. See, the states are the things in the 20th century that began to, in 19th, 20th centuries, it began to reify cultures. Now cultures had an army. Now cultures have a government. Now they're formally defined. You know, you're part of our people, or you're a traitor, or you're out. You know, it made culture much more, it froze culture, made it much more aggressive and much more defined like that. And that's a problem, the nation state idea. But that's, we're kind of stuck with that because that's the way the world is organized today. So I think what culture does, in a sense, what this, I was talking about this mosaic that was the Middle East does, it shows how cultures really get along with each other and interact and change and so on. That might be a much better model for a future in the Middle East than the nation states we have that Europe imposed. So the peoples here can't be defined by Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Gulf states, Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, Israel, Iraq, Turkey. You know, these are all creations. Yeah, there was no Iraq. There was no nothing like that. They were all European creations, British creations, and then French mainly. So maybe we should, you know, what the one state idea says in the end, our program for one democratic state, is one state is simply a stage towards what's happening in Europe to some degree, towards a wider sort of a confederation of peoples, you know, getting back to the, weakening the state, and getting back to the idea that we're kind of a federation of peoples that live in this part of the world, and we overlap, and we want to overlap, and we want to move with each other. We don't want to get blocked by checkpoints and borders. So that anthropological concept really dovetails with the traditional idea of what a society was in the Middle East. And I think it's a useful model for the future.
I was going to add to that. So with the One Democratic State campaign, I feel like you're saying that no one has to give up their sense of identity, whether it's their Jewish identity or their Palestinian identity. And these things don't have to be in conflict. We can sort of coexist with each other.
That's right. That's right. In other words, you have to disconnect the idea of culture. Nation is already putting it a little bit too strongly. But all right, you might say there's two nations here, Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs, because they've been forced to become nations. And that means they want states, and that's where you get that two-state idea that comes out as sort of a compromise. But it's not going to happen because Zionist settler colonialism claims the entire country. It would never allow a Palestinian state to emerge. So that's it's one nation state that's completely suppressing the chances of the other one having any space of its own. So then you have to say, all right, let's forget the states completely. Let's try to forget nations. And let's talk about the people that live in this country. Again, going back to the pre-settler colonial concept. This is a country. All right, now we're a country because we have to be a state. Okay, we're defined between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. We have Lebanon to the north and Syria. We have Egypt to the south. We have Jordan. So this is our territory. Okay. So all the people living in this territory should see themselves as a people. That's what we're living together. Now, we're different peoples. We're different national groups. There's Palestinian Arabs and there's Israeli Jews. There's different ethnic groups. There's Jews. There's different religious groups. There's Jews, there's Muslims, Christians, Baha'i, Roma, different kinds of religious groups. There's ethnic groups here. There's Roma, Circassians, Bedouins, Ethiopians, African asylum seekers, Russians. I mean, there's all kinds of groups that live in this country. African Arabs, they live in the old city and so on. Okay, there were different classes. You know, some of us that are middle class, you know, middle class Israeli Jews and middle class Palestinian Arabs kind of have much more in common than we do with the working classes and the poor people of our societies. So there's sort of an interchange there. So in other words, let's take this mosaic of who we are and let's build a country around that. Equal citizenship, equal rights, one parliament, one government, you know, one citizenship. All right. Now, within that, then you can have whatever identity you want to keep. First of all, there begins to be a sense of us. We have a national football team that goes to the World Cup in soccer. We have, you know, there is a us, whatever the us is going to be in this country, the new country. But you know what? If you still think that, you know, you're Jewish and you're religious, fine. You're Hamas, you could be Hamas at a Palestinian national, fine. Just like in the U.S., you can incorporate and accommodate different political ideologies, different ethnic groups, different religious groups, different cultures within a multicultural democracy. They don't have to be in conflict with each other. As long as you play by the democratic rules, you can be whoever you want to be with whatever narrative you want. You're free to do that. And that seems to be a much better way of organizing this society. And it's going back to the way it was in the days of the old Middle East than this European idea that we're a nation and we have to have an army and we have to defend our borders and these are our borders and we're us and these everybody else are our enemies or they're different or yes, you know, and that's certainly a alien foreign imposition on what the Middle East was, which was a dynamic, fluid sort of a multinational, multicultural region. It was a region. It wasn't a state. So, you know, I think that we have to have that sort of a vision. What we've done in the One Democratic State campaign, which is a Palestinian-led group that has this idea, is actually that we've gone beyond vision. We have a 10-point program. We really lay out how this could work. So we have a website that's called onestatecampaign.org. So you can go on that website and see. And, of course, the book I wrote, Decolonizing Israel and Liberating Palestine, tries to go into more depth about this one state idea and everything we've been talking about tonight.
I guess I wanted to ask, about the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, because I feel like, you know, I know a lot of Americans don't really understand the issues. They may be a little bit more apolitical when it comes to issues outside of the U.S. If they don't know about things like the housing demolitions or things like price tag attacks, what would you tell Americans? What do they need to know about these things?
Well, they need to know that Israel's a country. It's a nation state that has these structural problems that all settler states have of being oppressive and being exclusive and everything we've talked about with the Palestinians, but also that has real problems like any other country. You know, you're just celebrating, marking 100 years of the Tulsa attack, you know, the terrible pogrom in Tulsa that was 100 years ago. So, you know, the United States isn't, if you read Howard Zinn's The People History of the U.S., you begin to find a much more critical history that's very violent and very problematic. And Israel isn't some ideal country like the book Exodus tries to. Exodus is probably the greatest PR document in history. Everybody's read Exodus. And Exodus created this image of Israel as this country of the kibbutznik, and all we want is peace, and we're Holocaust survivors, we can't do anything wrong, and these Arabs are bad guys, and we're, you know, this very black and white sort of a narrative. And that's been very hard to fight, partly because Israel very skillfully uses anti-Semitism anytime you try to criticize it. So people want, you know, people pull back, especially politicians pull back. I mean, the last thing I need is for my constituents to call me an anti-Semite. I mean, if I want to get reelected, that's not what. So, you know, Israel has policies like demolishing Palestinian homes. Since 1948, Israel's demolished about 140,000 Palestinian homes as a part of an ethnic cleansing campaign because it wants to take the land and get rid of the Palestinians. Just in the attacks on Gaza this month, you know, probably 2,000 or 3,000, we don't know exactly, houses were demolished. You know, so that you know, this campaign of demolishing Palestinian homes, which is not done for security reasons, it's done because Israel does not allow Palestinians to build homes, and it destroys homes in military operations, is a part of its ethnic cleansing campaign. It's part of the Judaization process, and that's why we fight it.
So, in closing, how can my listeners keep up with your work? And the last thing I wanted to ask you, just real quick here, was, you know, I saw that one of our politicians here, Marianne Williamson, was actually sort of getting conflicted about this issue because she is very committed to the idea that there needs to be a Jewish state and that we should have a two-state solution. And I think people like her may worry, well, you know, what if something like the Holocaust were to happen again? I would want my kids to be able to go to a Jewish homeland to escape that. What would you tell people who have that fear?
You know, that's interesting. Probably if there was if it got to that, the last place Jews would go is Israel. It's happened actually that the, you know, when South Africa closed down or became problematic after apartheid, the South African Jews went to Australia or the US. The Jews of Iraq, those that had a choice, the middle-class ones, went to England. The Jews of Argentina, when the Argentine economy collapsed 20 years ago, they all went to Mexico and the U.S. You know, the Jews of North Africa, you know, in the 50s, when the poor ones were brought here, the middle-class ones went to France or Canada. So actually, when Jews had a choice, this is not the place they chose to come. That's one thing. The other thing is, again, you know, and you have to look at a way, you know, this problem of putting all your eggs in one basket. All the Jews come to one little country, and now, you know, that's nuclearized. That's the middle of one of the greatest conflicts in the world. I mean, is that exactly secure, long-term security? If something is this really where you want to get security from, coming to Israel, which is in the middle of this? So, you know. So the answer really is peace. And of course, this whole idea that you can't, the Jews are not an exception. The Jews have to see that their security comes from fighting racism, you know, fighting oppression, human rights everywhere. Your security as an American Jew comes from you're making America a good place for everybody to live. It doesn't mean that you're going to run off to some ghetto somewhere and try to find a false sense of security, especially when that ghetto is one of the most militarized places in the world. So this whole idea that Israel's a refuge, first of all, is not true. And second of all, you know, takes away from this idea that there aren't any refuges from violations of human rights and oppression. If your rights are being threatened in the U.S., the U.S. is where you have to fight for them.
Well, I want to thank you, Jeff Halper, for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work?
We have a website, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. It's ICAD, ICAHD.org. That's the house demolition Israeli piece of it. And again, the One Democratic State Campaign's website is onestatecampaign.org. And, you know, and people can always be in touch with me as well.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jeff Halper of the One Democratic State Campaign and the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Brian, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.